The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The competition for college admissions has spawned an industry of tutors, test prep courses, and consultants to guide students from choosing schools to writing essays. That whole kit and caboodle can cost anywhere from $6,000 to $15,000. Now, a growing number of foreign students setting their sights on American colleges and universities are also trying to get a leg up. Admission staff are combating a booming industry in China designed to help students fake their way through the application process, leaving U.S. institutions to figure out who's cheating. Jessica Myers is China correspondent for the Boston Globe. She and her colleague Laura Krantz reported on the often flagrant strategies of students paying to cheat their way in. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, Jessica, your article focuses specifically on Chinese students. That's where you are, but this could happen anywhere. But what is the appeal of American education in China?
Well, with China's expanding middle class, there is a prestige in the American college degree, and Boston is a prime destination for that. And so you're seeing an increasing number of Chinese students that can afford to go to U.S. colleges. And now we're seeing actually a record number at more than 300,000 Chinese students who studied at U.S. schools.
What are some of the things that tip admissions offices off that an application might be fraudulent?
Things such as looking at an essay and realizing it's actually a translation of a song. Sometimes there is discrepancies in an essay and also in other parts of the application. There's one example an admissions officer gave where she was conducting a Skype interview and a black cat was sitting on the student's lap. And she thought, well, maybe this is for comfort. Maybe she's just a bit nervous. And it turned out it was a mother whose head was on the girl's lap and she was whispering the answers.
That is crazy. Well, there are companies that are helping Chinese students get into American schools. So how many are there and what exactly are they doing?
Well, there are about 500 that are officially licensed through an affiliate connected to the Chinese government, but there are thousands more that are not. And many of them are helping students navigate this befuddling process. And this is not very easy for students that don't really know what a recommendation should be or have to ask teachers to write something in English with classes of 60 students. Extracurriculars are rather odd. So a lot of these companies are really just trying to help, but they're also ones that are exploiting students who are desperate to get into these schools. So you find a wide variety.
Are they committing fraud generally, or are some legit?
Some are very legit. A group that are sprouting up now that are helping verify students are who they say they are, and they're doing it through this video verification. There are actually these two new companies, Verikant and Initial View, that conduct these interviews and then provide them to the colleges so they can actually see the students. And they're trying to focus on alternatives beyond test scores, which are much, much simpler to falsify.
So they are countering these fraudulent applicants. They're trying to detect them. So are they working on the behalf of American institutions and schools?
Well, everyone is trying to make money here, but they'll tell you that that's their motivation and that's why they got into the business.
Well, it's an interesting pickle for American institutions because for most of them, a Chinese student or many foreign students will pay full freight. They won't get any financial aid package. So there's a lot of pressure or a lot of, let's say, incentive for them to let these students in.
Exactly. And a lot of the criticism is at U.S. schools for not trying to create different application processes, for sticking with the traditional one, or not making more of an effort to use these new companies, or to establish relationships with Chinese high schools that would take a lot more time and a lot more resources, but would also help ensure that students were who they say they are.
Well, you point to the SATs or standardized tests like the SATs as figuring into the problem. How?
Well, these tests for the SATs, they can't even be taken in mainland China. They usually have to be taken in Hong Kong, which is itself a very long trek for students. And you have students that also have found a way to substitute other students or other people to take the tests and have walked in and made a ton of money doing this. So it's actually can be quite easy to get an illegitimate score.
Of course, many American kids do plenty of embellishing on their college essays or applications. I don't want to pick on Chinese students. And obviously not all Chinese students are faking their way into U.S. schools. So, but how does this problem affect students who get into American colleges fair and square?
Well, professors are complaining that it makes it so that the classes are slowed down, that they can't teach the way they like to. They're quite frustrated. And Chinese students that are working very hard are saying, hey, you know, I'm still doing this work. Why do I have this reputation as a cheater? So you have this catch-22.
Any discussions about how to change or alter the admissions process to address this problem and in a more permanent way going forward?
Schools are taking some piecemeal steps. There are some that have decided to use these verification agencies through these videos, although that's often recommended instead of required. There are some schools that have hired companies that verify Chinese documents, so you can't have a transcript that is falsified. And some are starting to work with Chinese schools to make sure that they understand the process and even know the students a little bit better. So you are seeing some steps being taken, but still yet the overhaul, the systemic changes, changing the application process for foreign students, we're not seeing that in any major way yet.
Jessica Meyer speaking to us from Beijing. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jessica is China correspondent for the Boston Globe, and you'll find a link to read her article, which she co-wrote with Laura Krantz. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. In October, a huge gas leak was discovered at an underground storage field in northwest Los Angeles. Thousands of tons of the potent greenhouse gas methane have poured into the Porter Ranch section of the city. Methane emissions happen all over the world. Some leaks are vented and burned off with gas flares. Often, the colorless, odorless gas vents directly into the atmosphere, undetected and unreported. Until now. Christina Nunez writes in National Geographic about a new satellite imaging tool that can locate the biggest leaks and worst offenders. Christina Nunez, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So first, a little on methane, how it's produced and stored.
Well, methane is the primary component of natural gas. We have in the United States a long supply chain and, as you probably know, a huge energy boom over the past several years in producing natural gas. And one of the ways that it's leaking now is it's coming from oil production sites. A company drills for oil. They hit some natural gas along with the oil. It comes up and they need to dispose of it. So that's one of the issues that we're seeing with gas flaring.
What's the effect of methane on the environment?
Well, methane is a potent heat-trapping gas. It's 84 times more potent than carbon dioxide, and that's over a period of 20 years. So it's definitely a concern when it comes to the environment.
So we've probably all seen those images of, you know, a sort of like pipe coming out of the ground and then it's lit, so there's this burning flame. Now, this is what they call flaring, right?
Yes, that's right. The reason why you might see, if you're driving by an oil drilling site, you might see a sort of torch-like chimney, and that is how industry disposes of natural gas that it can't use. And the reason that they burn it is because burning it transforms it into carbon. As we mentioned before, methane is much more potent as a heat-trapping gas than carbon. So it is better to burn it than to vent it directly into the atmosphere. But either way, it does represent waste and additional emissions.
Mm-hmm. Well, many listeners may have been hearing about this particular leak at the Aliso Canyon because it's been leaking for months in a metropolitan area. But do you have any idea of how many similar facilities there are in the U.S.?
Yes, there are about 300 similar facilities in the U.S., and that's just storage facilities. So the Aliso Canyon facility was a storage facility that was sort of the last point before natural gas gets delivered to customers in that area.
How about all over the world? Anyone actually keeping track of how much methane is being vented into the environment?
Well, there have been a number of studies. A group called the Environmental Defense Fund has done a lot of work on this, and there are a number of scientists who are trying to track this. Studies have shown that more methane is leaking from U.S. oil and gas facilities than was previously estimated by the Environmental Protection Agency. It's also several million dollars of waste that's worldwide. It's billions of dollars of waste.
Now, as you've mentioned, methane gas is invisible and odorless, so very hard to detect just how much could be leaking and even how much is being flared at oil storage and production facilities. You wrote about a new satellite tool, this is called VIIRS, that is helping scientists understand the scope of the methane problem, at least when it comes to flaring. So what is this?
Well, this is a suite of infrared satellite technology that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, has been using to try to spot gas flares. One of the things that makes them so difficult to track is that there's no standardized reporting system across the globe for these companies that are flaring. Some of it's happening in remote locations, Siberia in Russia, Iran, Iraq. So there's no comprehensive way to really track this. And so NOAA has used this tool, which is particularly good at isolating these gas flares at night. And that's one of the ways that they've captured what's happening.
Well, a lot of environmentalists have actually seen the Aliso Canyon leak as maybe an opportunity or a call for action for the EPA to crack down. And indeed, late last week, the Bureau of Land Management proposed updates to its 30-plus-year-old regulations on oil and gas production to, quote, bring them in line with technical innovations in the industry, end quote. So what exactly is the federal government proposing?
That's right. And the regulations proposed last week will cover federal land. What they're proposing is that companies deploy more of this technology to find and fix leaks, update old equipment, and reduce flaring to the extent possible. Sometimes flaring is necessary for safety reasons, but a lot of the time it happens because there simply isn't a market or the infrastructure to carry the natural gas out. So they're trying to encourage companies to put in place the technology and the infrastructure to capture that gas.
And this is all on leased wells on federal or Indian land. So any effect on the uncaptured leaks that are being detected by technology like VIIRS?
Well, the Aliso Canyon facility, for example, wouldn't be covered by any of the proposed rules. That's one of the things that environmental groups have criticized the Obama administration on, is the fact that they're not covering the existing sources on private land. The latest rules for public lands would cover existing sources, but again, that's a small percentage. So there's still a lot of opportunity. The industry says that it is working to reduce leaks and flaring. It's already making progress and that regulation isn't needed. But obviously environmental groups differ.
So far, Christina, is there any form of accountability for offenders? I mean, can we compare this to dumping hazardous waste, or are gas leaks treated differently and especially as a byproduct of fracking?
Well, I think they are treated differently because, as we've been talking about, a lot of times they're going undetected, and the companies haven't even put in place the mechanisms to know where leaks are happening and to stop them. So right now, I think the EPA is focused on trying to get both voluntary and regulatory action, and they've been a bit vague about how enforcement would actually occur, but I think it's very early right now in terms of being able to detect where these things are happening and cut them off.
Cristina Nunez, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Cristina Nunez, she's senior producer and writer for National Geographic. Her article, The World is Hemorrhaging Methane, and Now We Can See Where, is part of a special series called The Great Energy Challenge. You'll find a link to read it for yourself and see a map of where the greatest known methane flares are at wordofmouthradio.org. And now on to the challenges of limiting a pervasive form of pollution that is all around us. This story comes to us from Open Orchards Production and youth reporter Katja Hauser.
What would you say are the top three polluting industries in the world?
The oil industry, the mining industry.
I think definitely one of them would be the whole oil company.
I would say agriculture and definitely oil are big ones.
Meat industry.
Fashion is actually the number two polluting industry in the world after oil. My name is Cheryl Marcus, and I was in the retail department store business for probably close to 17 years, and now I have been teaching at the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising for about 13 and a half years.
Do you know what fast fashion is?
No, I don't know what that is.
So if you look at fast fashion, which has become so popular both in its terminology and in its retail, it's typically known as being cheap and affordable, and their clothing that as a result of the catwalk can really be in retail stores quickly in order to respond to the latest fashion trends. Some of the stores that sort of come under that umbrella would definitely be Forever 21, definitely be H&M, definitely be Zara. I think that the biggest issue is that as a consumer, fast fashion also has you can call it throwaway fashion. So typically, it's very inexpensive. It is not intended to last, more than really a season. And what the problem is what do you do with all that fast fashion after you wear it?
The average American throws away 65 pounds of textiles a year. Not only do we throw away large amounts of fast fashion, but also this clothing is produced with large amounts of chemicals and toxins. Cheryl Marcus discussed an article that shed light on the detriments of fast fashion.
It's important enough that there was an issue this past August that for Newsweek, and on the cover of it was Toxic Fashion, the Environmental Disaster in Your Closet. What it really talked to was a place called Tirupur, and it was a clothing factory in Bangladesh, caved in, burying over 1,100 workers in the rubble, and really talked about all of the toxins that were in the water and the people that got ill in that part of the world as a result of it.
Over 2,000 chemicals, including lead, mercury, and formaldehyde, are used in the industry. Of these 2,000, only 16 are approved by the Environmental Protection Agency.
So yeah, I think it's pretty toxic.
Who should be held responsible for the practices currently used in the industry?
Probably the media.
Probably like big stores. They probably want the easy way out.
I think, when reading it, you might say that the most important, the person that should be held responsible is the producer or the retailer. And actually, I don't think it is. I think the person that should be held most responsible is the consumer. Because factually, as long as we continue to buy the clothing, then we're not sending the right message to the people that are producing the product.
What are some solutions to the fashion crisis?
There is a movement now towards fair trade, promoting agriculture diversification and not using pesticides and fertilizers, et cetera, et cetera. So, that's all a piece of it. The only other solution is going to be that people start purchasing clothing that is in fact sustainable and stop purchasing clothing that is not. And that's going to be a really hard sell.
Because of the higher prices of sustainable fashion, some people are not ready to shop sustainably.
Do you choose to shop sustainably, and why or why not?
No. Honestly, if I was shopping and I saw one that was sustainable and, good for the environment, if that, had a benefit to me, if it wasn't going to rip as fast or, it was going to last a longer time, which they usually do, then I would buy that one. But I wouldn't just say, oh, I'm going to buy the more expensive one because it's better for the environment.
I think I would, because then you're not, like, polluting the earth, and it lasts longer, too.
Yes. Also, it's a better quality. So, you know, if you have cheaply made clothes, they don't last as long.
Yes, especially the more I learn about it. Not only is it better for the environment, but because I personally like supporting local businesses that make it a goal to be better for the universe, not just these big corporations that where all they want is the money. These companies actually care about what's going into the environment, and that is why I choose to shop with them.
Whether your reason to change brands is improved quality, better materials, or ethical concerns, shopping sustainably will be the most influential action to reduce fast fashion's environmental toxicity. I'm Katya Hauser. Thanks for listening. To hear more stories like this one, please visit us at openorchardproductions.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From Burt Parks crooning the theme song, the swimsuit competition, to crowning controversies, the Miss America pageant is a staple of American culture and continues to hold a primetime slot for television viewers who want to see young, single women between the ages of 17 to 24 compete for the crown. But what happens to those contestants once they get hitched? Well, there's a competition for them, too.
At Eleanor Village, Florida, under waving palm trees, contestants for the title of Mrs. America get in a little waving themselves before judges pick the little woman who can cook best, bake best, sew best, plan meals best, housekeep best, and just incidentally, look well in a bathing suit. Yep, wives do take on nowadays.
Yes, the Mrs. America pageant. It is real, and it still exists today. Manisha Agarwal-Shifaledi wrote about the long and strange life of the Miss America pageant for Jezebel. And Manisha, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, some history first. When did the Mrs. America pageant start?
Well, the pageant was first founded in 1938 in New Jersey, and it's existed in one form or another for over 75 years. First in New Jersey, moving to Florida, and now making its way around the country and also around the world.
So why did it start? I mean, we had Miss America. Was that not enough?
I guess it wasn't. The founder of Mrs. America was a public relations man named Bert Nevins, and he wanted a way for people to stick around the New Jersey boardwalk once the summer high season ended. And he saw the success of Miss America and figured he could copy it with his own spin, which was that the contestants had to be married.
So how was the pageant different than the Miss America pageant?
Well, in the Mrs. America heyday, which was in the mid-1950s, the pageant was more of a housewife Olympics than anything else. So this was when the pageant moved to Florida, and Nevins had the idea to invite the women and their families down for a week, put them up in beach cottages, and let them kind of enjoy a little vacation while they participated in baking competitions, ironing competitions, sewing contests, and things like that. At the same time, judges would enter the women's homes unannounced to check the cleanliness of the cottage, see that the kids were in control, things like that. So the women were constantly competing for the title of best housewife.
Wow, doesn't sound like a vacation to me.
Not so much.
So this was in the 50s and 60s when it became very, very popular, the Mrs. America contest. Why do you think at that time it was such a big deal?
Well, this was really the era of focus on the nuclear family in America. There was a lot of pressure from pop culture, from government, and generally there was a feeling that in the post-war era, things were good. So there was more of a focus on a male breadwinner, a woman who stayed at home and took care of the house, and more of a focus on the suburban lifestyle. So in that sense, the women who were now working at home all the time were being celebrated as very patriotic figures.
Wow. And they're supposed to look good while they're ironing, cooking, baking, sewing, and cleaning?
Absolutely. There was definitely a focus in the pageant on looking good, keeping yourself groomed, but it was definitely not the most important part at this time. There was a lot of emphasis on the Mrs. America contestants being very good at their work at home, and the beauty component was supposed to be secondary.
I'm reading in your notes here also, encouraging women to look at housekeeping as a career.
Yes, that was one of my most kind of compelling things that I found out about the pageant was, especially in the 50s, there really was an encouragement of the contestants to look at their work at home with the same zeal and the same fervor that their husbands were presumably looking at their careers at with.
Manisha Agarwal-Shifaletti is speaking with us about the transformation of the Mrs. America pageant, which she wrote about for Jezebel. You know, I'm thinking the 50s and 60s, of course, you know, a growing awareness of feminism on some level. You know, we have Betty Friedan writing about the problem with no name, the feminine mystique. Were there any questions asked about whether or not we should be judging women based on how well they clean their house?
Well, one of the most interesting things about Mrs. America is that it really is and was one of the only venues where women were actually rewarded financially for this work. So in the 1950s, they were getting cash prizes. They were having their work acknowledged and recognized in this public venue. So in some ways, it was a very different way of acknowledging the work. But there wasn't too much backlash against it at the time. In newspapers covering the pageant in the 50s, it was treated a little bit like a novelty. And the pageant founder himself spoke in a New Yorker interview at the time and called it a publicity stunt that he had started. So it was kind of a fun way of looking at this housewife trend.
Well, of course, the definition of mothers and the amount of working women has changed so much since then. The family's really transformed a great deal since that heyday in the 50s and 60s. Is the Mrs. America pageant still happening?
It is definitely still happening. It happens every year. The Mrs. 2016 was from Alabama this year. And the pageant over the years has changed quite a bit. So it looks today more like a familiar pageant setup, like a Miss America, for example. There's a swimsuit competition, an interview, an evening gown walk, and there is a lot of more of a focus on the contestants' work outside the home. So what they do for work, their volunteering, things like that.
Well, Jezebel is a magazine that, you know, is a very strongly feminist magazine. When you were studying this, researching it, what did you think? I mean, should there be Mrs. America pageants?
Well, I found it very fascinating. I thought it was kind of amazing that the pageant still existed at all, which I think really shows the staying power of a particularly traditional institution like this, which would indicate that Americans do still highly regard the idea of marriage, especially for women.
Well, Manisha, this is a fascinating history, and I thank you for sharing it with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Manisha Agarwal-Shifaletti, she's a writer and editor and a contributor to Jezebel, where she wrote The Long, Strange Life of the Mrs. America Pageant. You'll find a link to her article and some fascinating videos at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Slaving over a hot stove or being handy with a needle and thread may not be essential for their unmarried counterparts at Atlantic City. Nor is this. But Mrs. America of 1953 has to be domesticated as well as dazzling. In the dazzle department, they do all right, too.
Watched faithfully by some and reviled by others, beauty pageants are among America's divisive traditions. But if one scratches beneath their shimmering surfaces, beauty pageants reveal quite a bit about shifting attitudes toward race, gender, and national identity.
Hi, I'm Afia Ofori-Mensa, and I teach a course called How to Win a Beauty Pageant at Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio. I think the educational value of studying beauty pageants lies in the fact that people can connect to them in some kinds of ways, but at the same time, they're foreign. They happen every year. Thousands of them happen in the United States alone. They happen all over the world.
Our first runner-up to Miss Africa USA.
Contestant number 24, Yoshiki Sindal.
How do you feel?
Salamat sa mga kababayan ko.
But they're also unusual. In some ways, it's like a subculture. It's not something that everybody does. But I have found almost always somebody says, oh, my cousin was in one, or my sister used to do those, or I used to do them.
When I'm not at work in elderly care, I love to volunteer at my local cat shelter as I have an obsession with cats. An interesting fact about me is I am the first Miss Gibraltar of Moroccan descent, which just goes to show what a beautiful, cultural, diverse country Gibraltar is.
When you talk about the titles of beauty pageants, like Miss America or something like that, there's a suggestion written into the title that this person is supposed to be a representative of a whole national group of people. And so if that's the case, we should be able to watch how that person changes over time, which is to say, who are the different winners year after year after year. And that can tell us something about how the nation, too, is changing over time, and tell us also something about ideals of femininity and how ideals of femininity tie into ideals of nationhood.
Women's roles in the U.S. have changed dramatically since the 1960s. What changes would you like to see next?
Well, I'd like to see changes as far as women also, well, like President Clinton is doing, he's getting a lot of women in the House of Representatives. I think that also,
relax. Take a second.
That first time that I taught it at the University of Michigan, there was this mid-semester evaluation process that we did there. And one piece of feedback said, I felt like the title was misleading. And that seemed to suggest to me that someone had actually taken the class hoping that they would learn the steps and tools for how to win a beauty pageant. Which was shocking to me because it was a 300-level American culture seminar.
Mallory, you have been a phenomenal Miss America. Are you ready to pass on the crown?
I am. It's time.
We do readings by scholars who have actually written specifically about beauty pageants. So Miss America, Japanese-American Nisei Week Queen pageants, Miss Fine Brown Frame in African-American communities in the 1940s. And so we do readings about those throughout the semester, coupled with theoretical readings that teach students about things like intersectionality, performativity, and how gender is constructed, and all these kinds of things. In addition to that, there's one capstone assignment centered on a field visit to the Miss Gay America drag pageant, female impersonation pageant.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 34th annual Miss Gay America pageant.
A lot of things that I say, like on the first day when we're reading the syllabus and that kind of stuff, suggest that this class is not going to be an easy class. Word gets around very quickly that I'm not an easy professor to take a class from. To some extent, I don't even have to do that work anymore. The reputation does it for me.
That story was produced by Taylor Quimby, and you can learn more about Professor Ofori-Mensa's course on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Having kids in early 20s brings no health benefits. NHS chief warns women not to wait until 30 to have a baby. Why it's harder for older women to have kids. The headlines are full of conflicting advice for women about when they should have children. But is there a right answer? Well, producer Marnie Chesterton looked into the numbers.
As women have children later in life, there's a subject that can get a little sensitive.
I'm sure my mother said something.
I think it is that after 35, then it takes quite a steep drop. As soon as I got married, it was like, right, when are you starting?
People started piling on because you must have a baby before you're 40.
Many women have heard this kind of stuff, whether from eager grandparents, interfering friends, or well-meaning health professionals. And the papers don't help much.
Major study showed fertility falling off a cliff edge beyond the age of 35.
The female fertility clock starts ticking at 27.
Infertility time bomb. Infertility is set to double over the next decade in Europe.
I get this mental picture of the fertility cliff here as an actual cliff, like in the Roadrunner cartoons, where our fertility drops off suddenly to nothing. Although there's a very confusing mixture of headlines to pick from. The age at which you suddenly become barren seems to vary quite a lot. So who's right? What's this all based on and who collected the figures?
A good place to go digging is here, the Wellcome Institute in London. It's a huge neoclassical building on a busy London road, built to house the medical curiosities collected by Anglo-American captain of industry Sir Henry Wellcome.
It's also home to all sorts of medical collections and libraries packed full of journals. And here in the main library, I've dug out a science paper from 2004 by Henry Leridan. And here's a sample from the introduction. Maternal age is clearly an important factor in reproduction. In populations not using birth control, fertility rates decline when the mother is over 25. Rates decline especially when the mother is over 35. Now, the guy mentioned as the source of that information is another Henry, French biostatistician Louis Henry, who wrote a lot about fertility from a stats point of view in the 50s and 60s. Luckily, given that I don't speak French, there's an English translation of some of his papers here. And when you start digging around in his tables, you find his source data, which are the French birth and marriage records between 1670 and 1830.
Obviously, we would worry that those data wouldn't be relevant to modern times. Things might have changed quite a bit. These individuals being studied back then, they might not be at all of the same fertility as modern women.
That's David Dunson, an epidemiologist at Duke University in North Carolina. More from him in a bit. But first, in case this doesn't raise any alarm bells, let me give you some context. We've got a study from 2004 using research from the 1950s and 60s, which in turn uses records from the 17th and 18th century in France. Back in the 1700s, in that part of the world, you were doing above average if you survived to 30. This data set spans several wars, famine, the French Revolution. This is all before penicillin and even a theory about how germs spread disease. Surely, women's fertility rates back then were subject to all sorts of different pressures than women in 21st century developed countries, with our antibiotics, vitamins, and lack of plague.
Extreme poverty and diseases, etc., could actually lead to substantially reduced fertility. We don't know a lot about what exactly these different factors are doing to fertility, but we would be surprised if they didn't do anything.
Professor Dunson produced a paper in 2004 looking at how age affects fertility, but using modern couples trying for a baby who reported their progress to European family planning centres. Even this group presented problems for researchers.
If you just take women of different ages and look at the proportions who conceive, that could be extremely misleading. So if you look at somebody who's at risk being a kind of funny term, but at risk of pregnancy at, say, age 35, well, a lot of these women are still attempting conception because they've had some problems with their fertility. They're going to be somewhat selected for having lower fertility compared to just a general population of 35-year-old women.
In other words, if you're looking at a bunch of women in their mid to late 30s who are trying to get pregnant, you're not getting a normal selection of the population. Women who are highly fertile are more likely to have got pregnant already by their mid-30s and are therefore no longer in the same trying-to-get-pregnant group. And ethics dictates that you can't just force a random bunch of couples to have unprotected sex and see who has a baby and how long it takes them, even for science.
you're sort of stuck with relying on observational data in which you don't have really a representative sample. That's most of epidemiology is really like that.
David puts his finger on why this is such a challenging area to study. Female fertility varies so much, and you just can't tell where a woman is on the fertile spectrum by looking at her. And this is why birth and marriage records from 300 years ago, while not ideal, are a useful rough guess of how much female fertility changes with age. I don't know why Louis Henry's research from the 1950s picked such an old data set, but until recently it was seen as good enough. David Dunson's study recorded stuff that no one did in the 18th century, like sex diaries. And does his study show a mid-30s fertility cliff?
No. I mean, I think you know the answer to that already, but for the vast majority of women, there's a slow decline in the probability of conception, and you don't have this kind of cliff phenomenon.
David's study found that 86% of women aged 27 to 34 could get pregnant within a year. For women a bit older, 35 to 39, that percentage fell, but only very little. 82% of couples could get pregnant within a year. But why does our fertility decline with age? Time to see the doctor.
My name is Yaqub Khalef. I'm a consultant.
Dr. Khalef is a consultant in reproductive medicine at Guy's Hospital in London.
Women are born with their endowment of eggs. They just don't make eggs during their reproductive life.
Our 40 years of reproductive life lasts from 15 to 55. And Dr. Khalef says that with every single period, we lose an egg. That's, by my calculations, about 480 over our lifetime. But we're born with a million, way more than we need. Most just disappear reabsorbed by our bodies. And the rest? Imagine them like a barrel of apples. By the time you've worked down to the ones at the bottom, they aren't the best.
It is a constant decline. The quantity is reduced, but the quality is also reduced because they have been there for much longer.
I noticed that you have a wall of babies behind you.
Yeah, that's what we live for. It all becomes worthwhile when we get that lovely and heartwarming letter or email saying, thank you very much.
So those babies on the board behind you, how old were their mothers?
This is two daughters. She was about 41.
Okay, so I'm 37. I don't have children yet.
Yep.
Give me some encouragement. I shouldn't panic yet.
Oh, no, you shouldn't panic at all. There is no reason to panic at any stage as far as I'm concerned. But there is also good reason to always make that decision as soon as you are able to.
Professor Joyce Harper, an expert in women's health at University College London, offers me a less reassuring second opinion.
To be totally honest, you should be panicking. I know that's a hard fact to accept. There was an excellent paper that came out recently and basically said if you want three children, you need to start in your 20s.
The reason I have two differing opinions from two people who both know their stuff is that this area of medicine is still the realm of the statistician more than the biologist. They've both given me a course of action based on probability. I'll flip a coin and decide whether to panic later. One thing they can agree on, there's no such thing as the fertility cliff.
Globally, fertility decline over 35 is an absolutely accepted position.
But it's a slide, not a cliff.
Yeah, it's a slide.
That cliff is imaginary. Biology does not know cliffs.
So where did the fertility cliff myth come from? David Dunson has a theory.
If you write an article on fertility cliffs, then a lot of people are going to read it.
Also, some studies just aren't well done, and there's just not the money provided to do the science properly.
Pregnancy issues, fertility, the funding would be a tiny, tiny fraction of the funding that's available to study cancer or AIDS research or cardiovascular disease. I've been working on it less, partly because there's not the funding.
It's a shame that something so fundamental, literally a matter of life, to a growing number of older parents, is not deemed a priority to study. Yes, as you approach 40, you won't have the fertility of an 18-year-old, but for most of us in our 30s, it's not a fertility cliff we're tumbling over. It's more of a slide, and in your later 30s at least, a gentle one. A final few encouraging words.
My name's Lorna. I'm 39, and this is Livia. She's 5 months.
Hi, I'm Linica. I'm 37 years old, and this is my son, Nevin.
I'm Charlotte. I'm 39. That's my baby, Elisa, who was born 3 months ago.
I'm Marnie Chesterton. This production is part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Thanks so much for spending some time listening to us today. We invite you to share what you heard with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of segments to listen to, post on social media, or email to friends. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.